Obviously, we haven't made a decision on that. I think there are a lot of people that would like to see those airplanes fly, and depending on where we are in the test programs, that'll be something we can sit, we'll consider. But certainly no decision has been made yet.
Wow, that was officially the first answer.
Should we just shoot?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sure.
Let's start with the obvious, the re-engineering, 737 re-engineering. Kind of give us your sense right now where you are in the process. You know, your counterpart has basically said it's, for them it's all but decided. You know, having announced you're studying it, it's kind of hard to then go back and say, yeah, we studied it, but we're not doing it.
Well, I mean, we haven't made a decision, and we're not going to be driven by Farnborough as a forcing function to make an announcement. We have been in dialogue with all three engine manufacturers. We think that all three of them have, you know, engines that'll improve the efficiency of the airplane by 10 to 15%. I've just appointed somebody to work that full time. Somebody that I really believe understands customers and understands how to configure airplanes, Mike Baer. And we're in the process now of doing trade studies. We've had various modifications of the 737 in the wind tunnel to see, you know, how a larger engine would perform with the different strut pylon. And we're now in the process of going out and talking to some of our key customers. Whatever we do is going to be driven by the customer. And we'll be talking to those people that are heavily invested in the 737 program. And I think they'll get us to the right place on the decision.
Continuing down that line, the C series seems to have grown from its very first beginnings, and now the way that Republic will configure it, it's a 138 seat airplane.
Yeah.
That seems to be right in the 700's wheelhouse. I mean, is that a fair characterization of that plane now, that it is now become a direct competitor to your product line?
Well, certainly, I think they've sized it to be a competitor, and they've also talked about having a larger airplane that would compete against some of the other models of the 737. I think it's really driven by the technology that's available. And can you close the business case for re-engineering? And then how long would a production line be in place for a re-engined 737? And then also understanding when new technology might come along that would really drive you towards a new airplane. So, you know, all of those things go into the equation. There are other things that go into the equation, too. I mean, this gets to be a very, you know, very complex algorithm that you have to plug it into. You have a new engine on an old airframe. You know, what does that do to the reliability of the airplane? The 777 or the 737 right now has a reliability mission dispatch rate of 99.9. You don't want to deteriorate that. They pay a lot of money for that kind of reliability. The other thing you have to consider is, let's just use Southwest as an example. They would continue to have the Classics and some of the NGs in their fleet, and now they're going to have another 737 with a different engine that they have to maintain. So, you know, what does that do to their maintenance costs? So it's not as easy as just to say, you know, you can get 10 to 15% efficiency. Let's go do it. I think the other point that I'd like to make is, whatever we do, we don't want to have an airplane that is just as good as the competitor. You know, we want to have an airplane that's better. And our view is the NG creates more value for our customer, and if our customer is willing to pay us more for that airplane. I don't want to have an airplane that just competes on par where it's really a price shootout. So there's a lot of things that we're looking at, and we're spending a lot of time talking about it. Every Friday, we have a little get-together, and we status where we are. You know, I have reached out and talked to some of our customers, and Mike Baer and his team will be reaching out to talk to our customers' technical and operations community. And again, based on all the information we get from them, it'll be what I'll call the airplane that the airlines want, not an airplane that we necessarily want to sell. Will be driven by that.
I
Have you curtailed the RS work as you're looking at re-engineering, or is that going on in parallel?
RS is Y1.
Replacement study. Then it would come.
No, that is still in the trade space. That's still in the trade space. And, you know, if we decide not to re-engine, that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to do announce a new airplane either. But we're looking at both of those things, and one of the charter that Mike has is to look at both.
The question, kind of following on the 10-15% improvement that you could get out of a re-engined next gen, in terms of that next airplane after that, you know, the magic number for a new airplane over today's existing aircraft is 20%,
yeah.
give or take, for something, you know, brand new, clean sheet. Do you then see that you'd have to get what essentially is 35% over today's 737NG in, say, the mid-2020s?
Well, I think you're probably adding the two numbers together.
I am.
I
but
think it's really about 20%, 20-22%.
Yeah.
You know, right now, I guess just a number of factors. You know, composite doesn't scale down nearly as well as it scales up. I think the other issue is, I'm going to kind of make up some numbers here, so stay with me. You know, say that the cost of a new airplane is, developing a new airplane is, let's say it's $100. And if you spend $100, you get a, you know, 10 to 15% efficiency improvement. If you were to do a brand new airplane, the cost would be five times that. So you're going to spend five times as much to get a nominal improvement. So again, let's break it down. 10% improvement for $100, 15% improvement for $500. I mean, those are the things you got to factor into the business case.
You said you wanted to have the best airplane.
Yeah.
But if Airbus re-engines, don't you have no choice but to follow so you can have the best airplane?
Well, I think we have a lot of choices. We have a lot of choices.
Well, what are those choices if you don't?
Well, I'm probably not going to tell you everything we're thinking about. You know, the one thing I miss about, you know, the defense side, I could run black programs. I could run classified programs and nobody knew what I was doing. It's a little harder on the commercial side, but I'm working real hard to keep a few things we're doing, you know, within the four walls of the Boeing Company.
Can you give me an idea of what's on those things?
I'd rather not.
Can you? I know this is going back.
Clearly, the re-engine, and there's some tweaks you can do to the current airplane, and then there's the new airplane. I mean, those are the things. But right now, we're about 5% better than the A320. You know, our view, and the customer's view is that also they pay more for our airplane. And if just by re-engineering we can't keep that margin, we may have to do other things. I think that's the point I'm trying to make.
Do you view the kind of the short-term options, just engine or something more extensive than, I mean, besides the structural stuff that you would have to do, but,
well,
you know, avionics and stuff.
Yeah,
like
I love
that.
It when the guys tell me it's a simple re-engine. You know, it's a simple derivative airplane. One thing that I've learned is there is nothing simple about a derivative airplane. There certainly is nothing simple about a re-engine. If you did a re-engine, you know, the pylon would change, the empennage would change, you'd have to raise the front gear a little bit, drive some different loads into the airplane, drive some different loads into the wing. But I will tell you this, I will do everything I can to reduce the requirements creep so it doesn't become the equivalent of a major change to the aircraft. And certainly we don't want to become a new airplane. When we do a new airplane, we want to bring the right technologies to it, which will really give us a leap ahead of what we've built to date and what the competition is building.
You just mentioned that composites scale up better than they scale down. Can you talk about kind of the challenges for scaling down composites, kind of what those difficulties are for example, achieving what would be a 31 a month rate with a composite?
Well, it's really not the ability to build. It's really, you know, composites are very strong, and we have, size the composite wing of the 787 to have the strength necessary to lift the airplane, but also to resist impacts, hail, you know, mechanical impacts. Start scaling it down, and you really have to have about the same thickness for a smaller airplane that you have on a bigger airplane, not because of the stresses caused by lift. It's really the impact that hail, again, equipment impact in the wing. So you really don't get the efficiency scaling down right now. You'd certainly get efficiency scaling up.
I guess the kind of to stay on that kind of 787 structure question, you're about to have your 20th 787 enter final assembly in the next few weeks. That's a big block point for you guys. It's a first time to get kind of the weight savings and design changes in. Can you kind of talk about what that airplane represents in terms of for the kind of new capabilities for 787, kind of getting back some of the lost range from the from the excess weight?
Yeah, I guess just to comment on the guarantees that we've made, we're getting a lot of good data out of flight tests. We don't have all the data that we need on drag and engine efficiency, but we're not seeing anything that would make us think that we're going in the wrong direction. You know, at the same time, we know that the empty weight of the airplane is higher than we originally envisioned for reasons that I think you all understand, and we have a series of block changes starting at block number 20. To continue to take weight out. We also have worked with the engine manufacturers to have a performance improvement plans in the engine that'll get the engine efficiency where we want. You know, based on everything that I've seen, I feel very confident we'll be able to meet the guarantees that we've given the airlines. Now, are the first few airplanes going to meet all the guarantees? No, we understand that. But I think that's pretty consistent with prior new airplanes that we've delivered. But as we get into airplane 20 and beyond and have further, block changes, I think we'll be able to certainly meet the guarantees we've made. I think the other point to make is the Dash 9 airplane. We're getting a lot of good flight test data on the Dash 8, which is allowing us to take additional weight out of the Dash 9. And at some point in time, we'll take all the things that we've done at the Dash 9 and roll a block change back into the Dash 8. And I think we can get this thing well, I won't say well below, but below the weight guarantees that we've made people.
Can you talk about the role of BCA is playing in helping the military side of the house to determine the configuration for the Air Force tanker?
Well, I've got a lot invested in the tanker program. I like to say that I've probably been on the program as long as anybody. And, this is one that, I've said there's no program that's going to make or break the Boeing Company, and the tanker program won't. The tanker program won't. This is very important to Boeing, and it's important to me personally. And having had the background on the defense side and having worked the tanker program for 8 or 9 years, I'm really driving our people to take cost out of the manufacturing side of the 767. Boeing Commercial represents about, in round numbers, about 70% of the cost of the tanker. And, on the military side, probably about a 30% value added. So we were working very closely with Dennis Muhlenberg's team. It's an integrated team. We're working it together, and we're trying to drive the price down and drive the efficiency up, and we've made a lot of progress. But I'm personally involved in this one.
Can you talk about any of the specific cost-cutting?
Well, I think the big thing that we've done is we're going to do all of the structural modifications necessary for the 767 in line in the factory in Everett. The original way that we've done derivative airplanes in the past has been you take a green airplane off the line, you fly it to Wichita, you cut it up, and you put it back together again. The way we're doing this is we're going to do all the modifications in line. We fly the airplane to Wichita, and they put the mission-specific equipment into the airplane. So it's a much more efficient way to build the airplane, and it'll drive the cost down for the customer.
Was that part of the proposal last time around?
It was partly, but not to the extent we're doing it this time.
What does it then mean for you on the commercial side, actually, to have the line open?
We get to build, and I'd like to think, in the event that we win, that we'll get a chance to build upwards of 400 767 tankers. And I say that because right now in round numbers there are 500 KC-135s out there. They're all going to have to be replaced. There's a good commercial market out there. I know we're not going to replace them airplane for airplane, but the way I'm looking at this is this will be a program that goes on for decades, and it'll be a program that can generate about $3 billion a year in round numbers for the Boeing company. And if you're building the same airplane time after time after time, you know, we can come down a good learning curve, and we can drive the cost down. And it'll be good revenue for the Boeing company. It'll be you know, jobs in the United States, and it'll be a lot of good work in Wichita, Kansas as well.
How much risk do you see, I'm asking, I guess we've been with your old heritage experience, but how much risk do you see in the new, the improved boom that you that is now part of the proposal?
With the boom, and we've been flying a boom on the Japanese tanker, the Italian tanker, and we've learned a lot, certainly. The offload requirement for the competition right now is about the same velocity or the same flow rate as what we have on the KC-10. So while it's going to require some development, it's not as if, you know, we haven't used booms with those kinds of offload requirements. So I think we'll be okay. You know, it's interesting. People talk about the RFP, how it was tilted, you know, against the Northrop airplane and towards ours. And I think that the U.S. government did a very good job of putting an RFP together to compete two dissimilar airplanes. And, you know, Northrop has been very public about some of the things that they didn't like about the RFP. Well, there are quite a number of things that we didn't like about the RFP as well, and I think the fuel offload requirement was one, because in our view it was sized to you know, what we think Northrop Grumman has done for the Australian tanker, and it wasn't sized to what we had done for the Japanese or the Italian tanker. The in-flight aero refueling model, our view was it gave more credit to a larger airplane than probably should have. How they escalated fuel costs in the out years, you know, our view was it did not favor a fuel-efficient airplane. Those are just examples, but we both have examples. And, you know, I think what Secretary Donnelly has said, that they tried to put an RFP together that was right down the middle. I mean, our sense was that it was. It was one that advantaged to some degree both airplanes and disadvantaged to some degree both airplanes, and I think they did as good a job as they could under the circumstances.
Last week, Airbus announced that they're kicking up the production rate of the A320 by 2 aircraft a month,
yes,
starting in December. Are you evaluating the 737 production rate and whether that needs to go up as well?
Yeah, we are. We made a conscious decision a couple of years ago to sell more airplanes than we had production capability to manufacture. And we did that because, you know, we always have some degree of deferrals. We know that some of the options, you know, aren't picked up by the suppliers. So we're overbooked in 2012. We're at capacity in this year, at capacity next year, and we're overbooked in 2012. And as the market starts to firm up, and we start coming, you know, back up the cycle, which we think we are, you know, we are looking very hard at increasing our production rate, and we'll make a decision on that in June. But we're sold out.
You know, the analyst community thinks you and Airbus really need to pull the plug for a while and stop building all these planes.
Well,
and I think the lessors feel the same way, too.
Well, we've been spending a lot of time with the analysts trying to get them to understand. But, again, we're overcommitted. The market's coming back. You know, we could have sold 200 more airplanes last year than we did.
You mean rolled out and delivered?
No, we could have sold.
Oh, sold.
We could have sold orders. And we didn't. We didn't take those orders because, you know, people wanted them at the bottom of the cycle prices.
So, well, that was one customer you're talking about.
I'm not talking about any customer. I'm talking about who could have. And, you know, our view was traffic was coming back this year. We're going to be back to 2010 levels this year for passengers, 2008 levels for freight in 2011. You're going to see the U.S. domestics become profitable. You're going to see them come back in the market in 2012. And we think we can sell some of those slots in the 13-14 time frame for a lot more money than we would have sold them for in the last year. So I think we made the right call. But again, we're overcommitted, and the pressure is upward.
you cut 777 rates last year. Any chance you'll look at moving that back up?
Stay tuned. We're going to make a decision on that in April. And we've got a, I think, you know, I said last week we had, you know, two campaigns that were working very hard. Actually, we had three 777 campaigns. And I think there's a very good chance we'll raise the production rate on 777s as well.
What are you on a 777 now?
We announced, I think, last March or April that we're going to go down to 5, and we're on the way down to 5.
Uh-huh.
Lead time away is about 15 months, and depending on our decision in April, it'll take about 15 months for us to ramp up.
How long does it take you guys on the narrow body side? Is it 9 months?
Actually, it takes a little longer than that, and your next question is, how can that be? Well, there are a couple of long poles in the supply chain we're working on.
The the new gen tanker has 787 flight deck, so it, you know, it pulls from the latest generation of avionics. Do you see any kind of modifications on whether it's a re-engine 737 or the next evolution of the 777, whether it's a new airplane, getting that same flight deck? Is that in the cards for?
Yeah.
Can you maintain a common type rating?
We're going to let our customer dictate, you know, what they want. You could put that new technology in. You would be somewhat incompatible with some of the fleets that are out there. And the other thing is that we drive the development costs up and ultimately the cost of the airplane up. So we're going to let our customers tell us what they want. But again, I think you got to watch out for requirements creep.
Mm.
Our engineers would love to put every bell and whistle on this airplane that they know of, and we got to resist that.
And for the A350, you know, you guys are really focused on the 1000, kind of waiting to see. You're expecting the 2017 entry is kind of the BCA expectation for that. There seems to be a sense that the 777-200 market, 305, 310 seats, has been surrendered to Airbus, where the majority of their A350 orders are with the 800 and the 900. Can you kind of talk about that market and kind of what you see is sort of the kind of getting it back and kind of what the you know, is the 200 dead?
Well, let me just say on just a general on the 777, in the 1000, you know, to me it appears to be an airplane that really has targeted the 777 marketplace, mm-hmm. more specifically I think the 300ER than anything. And you know, if that airplane is as good as it's advertised, and I'm not going to try to guess that it's not. I think the worst thing you can do is have a strategy of hoping that your competitors aren't successful. We're going to assume that they are. You know, that's one of the reasons that we've asked Lars Anderson to come out of retirement to help us figure out, you know, what we need to do to the 777 so it continues to enjoy the niche in the marketplace that it has. And you know, we're looking at a lot of trades right now on the 777, and we'll make a decision this year on what we plan on doing with that airplane. But you know, we're targeting to have a modified airplane in the same time frame that the Airbus is targeting to have the A350-1000 plus.
To what extent do those considerations affect your strategy on 787-10?
So, again, we've got a lot of things in the trade space. You know, 777, you know, being one of them, an upgrade to that airplane. And obviously, we'll look at the 1000 too. You know, what we don't want to have are two airplanes that compete against each other, and we're not going to do that.
This business of bringing back people who are retired, does that speak to maybe a dearth of younger people coming up? Did something happen that you have to sort of reach back and bring people back in and say, help us find a path here?
Well, you know, I came into BCA, and I'm kind of a student of history, and, you know, I know all the great things that Boeing has done, and I know all the great things that Boeing is going to do in the future. And what happened is a lot of the icons of Boeing Commercial, you know, left after the merger and then left in the early 2000s because we weren't doing development programs. And what I wanted to do is bring back some of these people who had been through very difficult development programs, people who had configured, you know, multiple airplanes over their careers, people that still had, you know, very good contacts within the customer community, And in what we're doing with the senior advisory group is, you know, we're bouncing some of our ideas off them. We're asking them to come in and sit in on some of the flight readiness reviews that we do. We're asking them to give me, you know, clear, you know, feedback from customers. And I think what I'd like to say is we're connecting the history of Boeing to the future of Boeing. And I think this group of people will help us do that. And I think this group of people can also be great mentors to some of the young people that are in responsible positions of Boeing Commercial right now. They're enjoying it. We're certainly enjoying it. They thought it was going to be a part-time job, and for most of them it is. But they're putting a lot more hours than I ever thought they would because they're having such a good time.
Just a bit of a far-out thing, but you know, one of the tensions in Boeing all seemed to be that the disagreement between the defense side and the commercial side on blended wing. And since you now have a stake in both camps, I'm just kind of wondering what your thinking is on that idea.
First of all, you know, there are a lot more similarities between Boeing Commercial and Boeing Defense, and I think in the past,
but they're boring.
People would like to say that there were differences. No, I think I make a very exciting video now that I'm on the commercial side. But you know, the engineering's the same. The laws of aerodynamics apply to commercial and military airplanes. How you manage programs, how you manage the supply chain, how you do risk management, how you do baseline management. Those are all things that are common. You know, as funny as it may sound, the customers are the same too. They just want you to deliver on the promises that you make. I think the big difference, of course, is commercial contracting versus defense contracting. But the similarities are very close. Now, I have been a supporter of the blended wing body because I think it's a very efficient airframe, and I think there are a lot of missions it can do, both on the commercial side and the defense side. And you know, the two different organizations have approached it differently. But again, I think if we get the aerodynamicists from both sides of the business together and start applying, the laws of aerodynamics and physics to what potentially could be a blended wing body, I mean, the real data will set us free, and we are spending money to do that.
Thanks. Back to the re-engineering narrow body talk. What do you think is driving all that? Is it the C-Series coming up into that space? Is it the Chinese launching the 919?
Yeah, I think it's all those factors. But I think more than anything, it's the next generation of engines and the need for our customers to have more efficient airplanes as the cost of fuel goes up, as the environmental requirements become tougher to meet, as the noise requirements become more difficult to meet. So I think it's more driven by the technology that's available. You know, that said, and I've said it a lot recently, we're not in a duopoly anymore. You project out 5, 10, 15 years, and we're competing against the Brazilians, the Russians, the Canadians, the Chinese, the Japanese. And, I've said we're not just competing against five companies, we're competing against five countries because they're all going to get, a lot of investment from their countries in order to have viable products. And, we have to make moves now to ensure that we're competitive 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to stay ahead of where other people might be going. And that's one of the motivators for taking a hard look at both the narrow body and the 777. You know, assuming that we do something with the narrow body and the 777, if you were to project out 7 or 8 years, we'd have a whole new product line from what we're offering today. An 787 that'll be new. We'll have a 747-8 cargo airplane and passenger airplane that'll be new. You'll have a narrow body that's different, and you're going to have a 777-like airplane that'll be different than what we're flying today. So we know that we got to continue to refresh the product lines that we have, driven to a large degree by our customers and also by technologies.
Did that kind of thinking help drive your decision about South Carolina? Did that play into that decision at all?
Well, I tell you, the global competitiveness thing did for sure. And, we have customers that expect us to deliver product when we say we're going to deliver that product. And we can't afford to have a labor stoppage every time that we have a labor negotiation. And we need to have alternatives in the event that, that we can't deliver product, you know, out of Puget Sound. The other issue is we need to be more competitive in Puget Sound. Again, the duopoly, it's gone. We're competing against, you know, other countries. We need to be more productive. We need to be more efficient. And we need to make sure that, you know, our airplanes continue to provide value greater than our competitors to our customers. And, you know, those are the motivators to making the decision we did.
From a profitability point of view, looking at, 747-8, you're obviously, you've been in a loss position for the last 6-7 months. How do you get out of that loss position? Are there campaigns to sell the freighter or the passenger version? And second, kind of in the factory, kind of, do you see an opportunity for investing in your supply chain in the same way that 87 did to kind of get the cost out directly?
Yeah, you know, on the supply chain issue, we've got a lot more control over the 47 supply chain than we do on the 87. But that said, you look at where the 87 is, and 87 is profitable. It's not as profitable as it needs to be to justify the kind of investment that we've made. It's really where the 777 and the 47 was when they entered into service. And we firmly believe that we can drive cost out of the 87 and drive cost out of the 47 and make them profitable. So, you know, how do you do that? Well, one, you know, we need to bring the lean principles into our facilities and drive cost out. On the 787, the last 5 airplanes we assembled in Everett, we assembled for about half the number of hours as we did the prior 5. We're seeing the quality of our supply chain improve dramatically. So we got to, you know, work internal to Boeing. The other thing is we need to work value engineering with our supply chain and drive the cost out of what they're producing. The third thing is we need to sell the 787 for what I believe is value to the customers are. I think we sold those a little cheaper than we probably should have. You know, on the 47, we could have sold a few more 47s last year, but it was the bottom of the freighter market. I mean, I think you all saw how the freighter traffic just the bottom fell out, and nobody was in the market, and if they were, you know, they were bottom feeding. Freighter traffic will come back, and this will be by far and away the most efficient freighter there is. And I think as the freight markets come back, we'll be able to sell quite a number of those airplanes. You know, on the passenger side, we were, you know, very pleased that Korean Air came in last year, November, December, and made a purchase. And, you know, I think that airplane is positioned very well below the A380, and I think it'll have the reliability and the efficiency that the customers want. It won't require as thick a route to support it. I think we'll sell a lot of those passenger airplanes too.
I mean, you're kind of talking about, you know, a couple of times having avoided, you know, basically discounting too heavily during the downturn. Mm-hmm. Airbus also has been on that side extremely disciplined, and, you know, this time around, or seems to have been more disciplined.
You got to remember that in 2007 we sold 1,400 airplanes.
Right, but I'm curious, how worried are you that when we really have Bombardier and the Chinese in your market space,
yeah,
out there, that that kind of discipline is going to be out the window, and when the downturn comes,
yeah,
it'll be a race to the
bottom.
See,
I think that's a very good point. And if we have an airplane that, as I call it, a me-too airplane that isn't any better, it is going to be a price competition. What we want to have is an airplane that over the life cycle of that airplane is going to create much more value for our customer than the competitors. And if we can do that, it won't be a me-too airplane. People will pay a premium for the Boeing product. That's what they've done on the 737 next generation. That's what they've done on the 777-300ER. And we always want to make sure that our airplanes create that value, that extra value that our customers want.
But you have to be careful, don't you? I mean, a few years ago, in the days of Harry Stonecipher, where the phrase, we're only going to do deals that make sense, came around. And that was an old line at MACDAC, too. And Boeing lost some sales campaigns that Boeing really expected to win. And I remember the big AirAsia A320 order, where Tony Fernandez basically said, look, Boeing never came to the table with an offer. And it seemed like there was an era where, well, we're selling our planes,
yeah,
too cheap. our plant, but in the market you're in, where it doesn't seem like pricing power really exists the way it should in a duopoly market.
Well, I tell you, I think it does. You know, we've got a backlog of 3,400 airplanes. I mean, we don't have to do a deal to keep the production lines running. And, you know, our philosophy is design a better airplane, and people will pay a premium for a better airplane. And, you know, the deep discounts just to get an order, while short-term, it'll make you feel good, and the backlog will look good. You got to make money. Why do we need to make money? Well, you know, we develop our airplanes the old-fashioned way. You know, we pay for them. We're not getting subsidies. We have to make money so we can develop the next generation of airplanes. But we're going to remain disciplined.
You mentioned when you were talking earlier about the re-engineering concept, and one of the variables being, of course, reliability. How much, I guess, if you look at the engine providers, even though they can give you the fuel burn, how worried are you that they just don't have the reliability that people have come to expect of a CFM56?
Well, I've looked at some development plans over the last couple of weeks, and there's a lot of things that they need to do to get to the technical requirements level that we think they need to be at to make a real firm decision on putting one of those engines on the airplane, and they are stepping through that right now. I don't want to get into the names of the engine manufacturers, but one has done more test time than others. Some of the designs are more on paper than they are real, but they're all making a significant investment, and based on our audit of what they should be able to do with these new engines, it clearly provides something that I think our customer will want in this era of higher fuel costs.
And I realize the open rotor is many years away if it arrives, but when you look at it, I mean, do you have any kind of aesthetic or sort of, ooh, I don't want that thing on a Boeing airplane kind of, because there is that, I mean, some of your biggest customers have had that kind of reaction.
Yeah.
Can you be a totally detached person when it comes to something like that?
No, I don't think that we can be totally detached from it. I think we got to be driven by our customers. And if our customers have concerns, we have concerns. The technology looks promising. A lot of work needs to be done before I think anybody's comfortable with it. But, to get the next generation, after the engines that are coming online in the middle of this decade, you have to go to something like the open rotor. And clearly, people's attitudes change. I know that when we went from piston airplanes to jet engines, there's a lot of concern too. And of course, we had the reliability issues that I think you're all aware of. But I don't think anybody is going to do something that hasn't been proved on the test stand and doesn't have the confidence of not only the engine companies, but Boeing and the user community. And I think over time you can get that.
You talked about the duopoly being gone. What is your view on where the Chinese are right now? I mean, are they where Airbus was in 1970? Are they further along and going to come up
yeah.
the curve faster?
Well, I mean, I think they are where Airbus was 25, 30 years ago. And, the Chinese government has said that they're going to make a significant investment in commercial aerospace. They have stood up COMAC to build the 919. They are going to put the best and brightest on the program. It'll be probably a good airplane. Will that be the airplane that they market outside of China? Probably not. But the airplane after that or the airplane after that, eventually will be a good one. And I think we have to look, at China as being a real competitor in years to come. I worked in the space business for a lot of years, as I think some of you may know, and I know how difficult it is to put a human into low Earth orbit. And there are only three countries that have done that. One of them is China. If they can do that, they can do just about anything they want to do. And I had a good friend of mine who worked at the State Department, and I was talking to him about China a while back. And he said, the Chinese always do what they say they're going to do, but what surprises me is they always do it sooner than we ever expected. And we are formulating right now what our China strategy is. And we do a lot of work in China already, and I think over time we'll probably do more. It's a big market. It's about 200 airplanes a year for a lot of years, and you know, clearly the 919 will command part of that. We want to make sure that we continue to be a major player there.
Can you talk about resource? You know, we've asked you a million study questions, and you've got a million studies going on. Do you have the engineering capacity to handle all those, and to what extent does it constrain what you do?
Yeah.
And also from a money perspective?
Well, you know, our R&D spend is going to go down as we start taking people off the A7 program and the 47-8 program. We understand that. It's interesting. I don't care where you are. It's not just numbers. It's the right people. And as we start to configure, you know, what the new narrow body or the new 777 would look like, we really do need some of the airplane, aerodynamicists that we have on some of the other programs. So we are really stretched on some key people to support some of the studies. And one of the things that we're doing right now is we're doing some triage on some programs that we're not going to bet on. And we need to really focus on the two or three that we think will pay benefits, and we're in the process of doing that right now.
You said the new narrow body.
Don't read anything into that.
Okay.
Whatever the narrow body is going to look like.
I guess what I mean is it going to? I mean, is it going to be? People have said maybe it's 170 seat wide twin aisle. Maybe it's not a new narrow body.
Yeah. Well, the small twin is something that has been talked about.
7J7.
And it's part of the trade space.
You mentioned that you expect the tanker to bring in about $3 billion in revenue every year. I wonder, how does that compare to the previous RFP? Is this one more favorable or less favorable in that regard?
Well, so the last one was cost plus development. And I think on the first 60 or so, it was fixed price. And then there was a budgetary number for the last 110. Is that about right, Dan?
That's correct.
And this one is all fixed price. I think up through about 80 airplanes, and then from there on, it's not to exceed. But you know, whenever you make an RFP fixed price, you know, we're going to put some money in there for risk. The expectation, certainly, of the Air Force is that it'll be a number, I think, reasonably close to the prior one with escalation, and we're trying to drive to a number that'll win. You know, our view is there's still competition ongoing. Nobody's told us there's not. The proposal is due on the 10th of May, and we're acting like we got to win this thing.
You know, there are concerns both on the congressional side and also on the executive leadership side about how does the Air Force get the most competitive price with only one bidder.
Yeah. Can you have to remember that, you know, sole source is not something that doesn't get done. It does get done. And we have told the Air Force and the Department of Defense that, you know, they'll get full insight into our cost and pricing information, and they will. We're going to be fully transparent on everything. Now, I don't want you to write that ABA says it's going to be sole source. We're not assuming that. You know, our assumption is it's going to be competitive. But in the event that it's not, clearly they're going to go through all the cost and pricing information in excruciating detail, and we're going to make sure that they have full access and we're totally transparent on things.
In your interview with the Seattle Times a few weeks ago, you talked about both the union's failure to reach an agreement and Boeing's failure to reach an agreement on whether it was the 2008 strike or the agreement on the Charleston final assembly line. Can you kind of talk about how the relationship got to that point, and also kind of what can be done to repair it?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't around, the last several decades, so I can't tell you how it got there. You know, my theory is it was a lack of communications on the part of the Boeing company. You know, I think that we can get ourselves in alignment with our union. I mean, what do we want to have? We want to have profitable growth. We want to be competitive. We want to create jobs now and into the future. And the only way you do that is to have alignment on where you're trying to go as a business. And there are a lot of constituencies in our business. There's SPIA, there's the IAM, and there's management, and there's the supply chain. And one of the things that I'm going to work very hard on is to get alignment of where we're trying to go. And once we get that, then I think we can start working through the details of how we get there. You know, flexibility of work rules so we can compete effectively against not just one competitor, but four or five competitors. How we can assure that we are providing an assured supply of airplanes to our customers when we say we're going to deliver, as opposed to having work stoppages every 3 or 4 years. You know, the fact that you have a work stoppage costs us a lot of cash. That's cash that could be invested in new airplanes to create more jobs. I think we just need to be real clear of where we're trying to go and to get everybody to rally around doing the right thing for the customer, for the company, and the employees. And we've got 2 years before the next negotiation, and I'm going to spend a lot of time trying to communicate to the team. But, you know, read the strike is an indictment of the company, you know, just as much as a reflection, just as much as it is a reflection on the union. Either one of us got it right.
757?
757.
Or how do you replace it?
Oh, well, right now we're thinking about again, we got the two new airplanes that are in flight test. We've got the re-engine or new narrow body, and we've got the 777. Quite frankly, I'm not thinking too much about the 757 replacement right now, although it is a market that I think at some point somebody's going to fill.
You recently celebrated your 6th month anniversary on this new job. How long do you see yourself staying in this job? Do you see yourself as a guy who comes in and fixes things, or do you plan on staying at this job for several more years?
You know, I've always had this theory on jobs that never be thinking about the next one. Think about the one you have. And I'm enjoying the one that I have. It's a great team, great customers, in the middle of two really groundbreaking development programs. I don't think I was sent up there just to try to fix things. I think I was sent up there to run the business, and that's what I'm going to try to do. I don't have any short-term plan. My long-term plan is to make the Boeing company as good as it can be, and make the 87 and 47-8 as good as it can be. Plan for the future relative to new airplanes, develop the leadership team, and meet the plan. I mean, those are the things that I want to do, and that's what I'm thinking about.
You talked earlier about the pricing on the 787. You kind of was an acknowledgement that you sold the early ones for a little less than you had hoped. Can you kind of talk about the pressures that created that situation? Was there a go fever at the time to build the backlog? Was the 350 sort of what essentially got you to that point? Because on top of that, you have the money you've invested since then, and also penalty payments and so on and so forth.
Yeah, well, I wasn't around when they were selling the airplanes, but I look at the airplane and the value that it provides to the customer, and obviously you don't give away all that value. You share in that value, and I want to make sure going forward that we share appropriately.
Coming back to the C series, but not re-engineering. Bombardier has kind of said, Airbus and Boeing, they really don't care about that market below 150 seats. The 600s doesn't really sell much. The A318, they kind of pretend the 719 don't compete in the market. Do you accept the premise that you really aren't that interested in the market below 150 seats?
Well, I look at the 737 business that we have, and it is one of the cornerstones of Boeing Commercial, and it's a marketplace that we're going to defend. We are not going to cede that marketplace to the competitors that are entering that space right now.
I do want to get back to re-engineering. Sorry. But
yeah.
What do you think is, to close a business case, what do you think realistically the life has to be on that product?
Yeah, I think that's one of the big issues. It's one of the big issues. If you were to only have a production run of 5 to 7 years before you had new technology in a new airplane, are people going to want to take on a dissimilar fleet? And will you be able to sell those airplanes at a high enough price to depreciate the investment that you've made? Those are all the right questions to be asking, and those are all the things that will go into our analysis.
So yeah, I just haven't come to close on that yet. I mean, on that specific question.
We have not. But it's one of the questions that we have on the table.
The other thing is, if you do it, how do you manage the back? I'm sure you did this with 737 and the NG, but I just don't remember.
You go back to the NG introduction and the pricing and the orders for the Classic held pretty well. And I think part of that was we were in an upcycle. I think right now we're entering an upcycle. So I think the timing is right if you decided to do something like that. And it's going to take a long time to replace the NGs that are out there in the event that we were to go to a re-engine airplane. So I'm not as worried about that as some might think I should be, but that's one we looked at pretty hard.
Let's go back to the tanker for a second. A lot of people in the Boeing company have said that you said earlier we haven't won yet, and we expect it to be a competition. Are there any indications? Who do you see being your competition right now?
Well, I mean, all I know is what I read in the paper. All I know is what you guys are writing. I don't have any keen insights into what Airbus might do or who they might team with in this country or if they're even having dialogue. I really don't know. But in this business, you have to be always paranoid and ever vigilant.
Engine exclusivity is clearly the trend you've been moving in. It's beginning with the 737, continuing with the current versions of the 777, 747-8, maybe the 787 is the odd case. So it raises the question of anything that, is sole sourcing of engines just something that's sort of for you become just de rigueur, something that you're really comfortable with?
It's interesting. I think what happened is you had a series of decisions that put us in a position where the vast majority of the engines are coming from one company. And we got to that position because that company provided very good engines. But it was not a policy decision that we would only have one engine supplier. And we believe in competition. We certainly want to talk to all the engine suppliers. But you look at history, we've had a very good relationship with CFM and with GE. Those airplanes perform very well, and GE and CFM have been a big part of that. But we do not have a policy or a strategy of only doing business with one company. If one company continues to provide the value that's the best, we'll continue with the direction we've been going in, but it certainly is not anything that we talk about as a strategy. It's not. I think competition is a wonderful thing.
I just want to follow up on something John mentioned. Just the question was, what's the market activity right now kind of in the 747 arena? Is there life, or is it still pretty quiet?
Well, certainly
right now?
In the freighter market, there's not a lot of activity. There are quite a number of 747 conversions that are parked.
Right.
And those are going to have to come out of the desert, I think, before you see a real uptick in the demand for the freighter. But that'll be driven as the freight market comes back. And again, we think it'll be up to 2008 levels next year. And then from there, as globalization continues, there will be demand for that airplane.
And on the passenger side?
We're having a few discussions, but I think we need to get that airplane into EIS. We need to get it in the service, demonstrate how good it is, be able to show people data as opposed to view graphs, and then as they start to replace and recapitalize, I think the market will be there.
Go back to another joint military-commercial program. The Air Force is going to have an Air Force One competition probably coming in the next couple of years. Other than the requirements aren't fully fleshed out there, do you see anything other than the 747-8?
Well, certainly, they've always had a requirement for a four-engine airplane and a large airplane. And, depending on what the RFP says, of course, the obvious entry that we'd have in that competition would be the 747-8 passenger airplane, yes. Now, I do find it interesting. heard a lot said about a closed market in the United States. I know when they put an RFI out a while back on a replacement for Air Force One, that they sent that RFI to both us and I think to Northrop Grumman and Airbus. I don't know if they replied or not. I know we did.
You mean the LSA didn't ask you to bid for their fleet replacement?
I haven't got it. I've not seen the RFI.
Going back to production rates, you had said that the 3-7 is overbooked overbooked in 2012 by capacity in 2010, 2011.
Yes.
What's the status of the 777?
Well, again, we went down to 5, and the fact that we're talking about going up in rate, or thinking about going up in rate, would tell you that we have had some orders, and we anticipate additional orders coming. You look at the airlines, and you people know this because you follow the industry. You know what generates profitability for them? I mean, everybody thinks it's a fuel burn efficiency. It's not. It's really that one extra passenger, the added revenue, that one extra seat or an extra three rows. And if there are passengers that want to fly, they're going to buy equipment to fly those passengers. And we are seeing a lot of interest in the 300ER especially.
And actually, at the J.P. Morgan conference, you discussed the improvements to the 777-300ER that were coming. Not the performance improvement package on the 200ER, but the new increased zero fuel weight of the 300ER. Can you kind of talk about that product a bit more and kind of, is that factoring into your, as one of the offerings for your customers on those three campaigns you're talking about?
What you're always trying to do with every product you have is do incremental improvement. And there are a number of things that we can do to improve incrementally the performance of the 700. One clearly is fuel burn and engine efficiency, and we're working that. We have gone out to our customers with other ideas, extending the wing a little bit, other types of things. And depending on what our customers want and what they want to pay for, we'll do those things. But we're in discussions, not just about what we might do as a major upgrade to the 777, but incremental things we can do between now and the end of this decade.
And are those incremental things playing into Lars Anderson's work, or is it sort of a separate?
Well, they really have to be looked at collectively. If you were an airline and you saw a new airplane coming, again, would you want to have a fleet, a small fleet of different airplanes than the ones you're flying today? All those things factor in. And Lars is getting a lot of frequent flyer miles. He's talking to all of our big customers right now.
I think
probably had just a couple more questions.
Close to one. So
you talked about a modified 777, possibly re-engineering the 737. You guys are still going through on the 87. Are you confident you have enough that you're not stretching your engineering team?
Well, we're looking at that ramp as people come off the development programs. Where can they go? The thing that I'm pleased with is we have developed a new cadre of engineering program management talent, and they've gone through the wars of a development program. They understand best practices, they understand risk management, they understand the fact that there are technologies that we need to hold dear and hold close that we probably shouldn't subcontract to others. And where we do subcontract to others, we need to provide much more oversight than we have in the past. So I'm confident as we go in to other derivative programs or new development programs that we have the team that can do it. And do it, I think, with more predictability than we have in the past.
Just on tanker and the production question,
yeah.
When does that line actually become an all-tanker line? And then also, how do you handle the ITAR requirements?
Well, we have set up an ITAR line right now. We're prepared to set up an ITAR line,
right.
And we've done it on the P-8 program,
right.
So we understand how to do that. On the 767, we have commercial orders for the next several years, and it dovetails pretty well with the tanker program. As we start delivering 787s in quantity, you're going to see the market for the 767 commercial airplanes go away. So the idea on tankers, it would be a dedicated U.S. Air Force tanker line, and we would not mix commercial airplanes with it.
So it's basically try to push out the commercial ones before
yep.
tanker program really starts.
Right.
Okay.
Can you talk about the maturity of the Charleston workforce right now? In terms of, it was kind of a struggle getting the VOT portion to kind of building at the same rate that essentially that you had the rest of the supply chain moving at. And talk about kind of the working with composites and how that has changed over, you know, your time as head of BCA and sort of where you see that, where's that going?
Yeah, the workforce there, I mean, they are very eager to learn. They're excited about being part of Boeing, and they continue to come down the learning curve. And I'm really pleased with what we've seen. I think the bigger issues that we've seen in Charleston don't have to do with the workforce. It's more about the supply chain coming in to Charleston, and also the planning and the amount of planned work versus unplanned work and all the change traffic. And that's what's driven the inefficiencies in Charleston, not the employees. You know, we have brought dozens of managers and engineers from Puget Sound who really understand how to build airplanes, and they are very pleased with the workforce down there. All right, I think I got to run to my next couple of meetings this afternoon. Thanks
for the time. Thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
We'll set this up again every quarter or something like that. Work?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
A couple of things. First of all, you're welcome. The food is very good, I think. You're welcome to have something to eat before you leave. The other